This is The Takeaway for January 6, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And 8 years ago, remember 8 years ago, the global economy was, I don't know what to call it. Was it in flames, sinking into quicksand? Remember all the hyperbole back then? I mean, if today you say, it's going to be another Lehman Brothers, the color drains from people's faces. I mean, everybody knows what you're talking about. Here's a small list of all the books, and there's way more than this, on the 2007-2008 crisis. Fault Lines, Stress Test, All the Devils Are Here, Colossal Failure, After the Music Stopped, Bailout, Griftopia, Meltdown, Meltdown Iceland. I missed that one. Panic, Predator Nation, Crash, Too Big to Fail. You can feel the collective yearning for a decent analogy to describe this unprecedented situation. Unprecedented situation. There's a good title. No, bad title. Worse analogy. I'm no good at this. But analogy or not, today the unemployment rate for 2016 is 4.7%. That's a tiny rise. And it's the lowest year-end number in a decade for the unemployment rate. There were 156,000 new jobs and wages increased solidly last month, the biggest rise in 7 years. Is that the final verdict on the Obama years, economically speaking, handling the financial crisis back in 2009, but limping to the present slow rate of growth and all the persistent unemployment, which may be why Donald Trump is president-elect? Well, here to help us with economics history and, I suppose, analogies are Kenneth Rogoff, professor of economics at Harvard and a former chief economist with the International Monetary Fund, and the great Gillian Tett is with us, U.S. managing editor of the Financial Times. Kenneth, Gillian, welcome to The Takeaway.
Great to be on the show.
So happy new year to both, of course. And is it a happy new year for the economy after 8 years of Obama, Kenneth?
Well, I think it's been getting a lot happier over the course of the year. President-elect Trump inherits really a pretty good economy. It's been doing a lot better. I know during the campaign he said it was just awful, but it's really recovered very substantially from the financial crisis. Yeah, there are problems, but it's way better than it was 5 or 6 years ago.
And Gillian, this is the key tension to me, that if you do look at the traditional economist numbers, you get a fairly rosy picture. But if you listen to the message from the campaign, as far as the middle class was concerned, Obama did nothing.
Well, there is a terribly bitter irony that hangs over the Obama legacy, which is that he came in at a time of financial crisis when the economy really was tipping towards a recession, if not depression. He unleashed policies that avoided that depression and put the economy back on a fairly healthy footing. But tragically, in some ways, it's probably going to be President Trump who gets much of the credit for it. Partly that's a question of timing. It's also because of one fatal mistake that President Obama made, which is that he'd spent a lot of time talking about financial reform, a lot of time talking about the banks. He did not spend as much time talking about jobs and job growth. And tragically, he's paid dearly for that.
Kenneth, there was a discussion, I remember, and actually quite a serious disagreement a couple of years into the first term, over whether to extend the stimulus package to really go aggressively at infrastructure spending and other kinds of things that are being talked about now in the lead up to the Trump administration. Was that an appropriate discussion? Where do you come down on that? And is it the case that maybe now is a better time for those expenditures than was the case 5, 7 years ago?
Well, I think 5 and 7 years ago, economists across the spectrum favored vastly greater infrastructure spending. Interest rates were low. Construction workers were unemployed. It was a great time to do infrastructure problem. But I think it sort of comes to the, you know, center of what faced President Obama. He's president. He's not emperor. He faced a Republican Congress that was very obstructionist. They were very angry about Obamacare, thought it would someday add 15% to the tax rate, you know, the way Social Security does if you add it all up. And so I think that although actually there was quite a lot of consensus, it was an extremely dysfunctional government. So I don't think the Obama legacy is just Obama's legacy. It's also the Republican Congress's legacy.
Do you think the president could have convinced that dysfunctional Congress to go for infrastructure if he had just delayed Obamacare and done what Rahm Emanuel suggested, get, you know, leave of health care for the second term?
Well, I think that Rahm Emanuel's advice in retrospect looks extremely sensible. The problem with Obamacare is that it consumed most of President Obama's political capital, if you like. And the issue was partly that Congress was being very obstructionist. There's no question about that. And the Republican Congress bears a lot of responsibility for what's happened. But there is also an issue about President Obama's priorities as well. If he had spent as much time talking about jobs as he spent talking about bank reform during his first term, we might be in a very different position today. And if he had done what people like Professor Rogoff were suggesting 6-7 years ago and actually unleash an infrastructure plan and a program to help American families on the same scale as he spent time looking at Obamacare, again, we'd be in quite a different position today politically and perhaps economically too.
I want to say that, you know, in terms of President Obama's legacy, people kind of forget that we really could have fallen off a precipice, and we didn't. We didn't have the Great Depression. We could have. It's so easy, you know, to just second guess we should have done this or that. In real time, making real decisions. Let's not forget that a lot of the forecasts around the time President Obama was making these decisions from the Federal Reserve, from his advisors, were pretty optimistic. They said that things were going to get better a lot quicker than they did. I argued at the time, based on history, that that's not true. But it's very tough. I commend to you the recent Tom Hanks movie, Sully, where they sort of analyze what could he have done other than land on the Hudson. He landed on the Hudson. Everyone survived. But then they did these simulations and said, look, if you turned around, you could have landed at LaGuardia, another airport. And, you know, but then they looked at it more closely and said, yes, if you knew everything that would have happened, if you made a decision instantaneously, if there's no human factor. But President Obama didn't have 17 times to practice this. He didn't know instantaneously what was going on. And I think history will give him a lot of credit for averting what really could have been something much more horrible.
Well, as luck would have it, I actually watched Sully yesterday, and I think it's an absolute brilliant analogy because, in fact, the human factor, as they say in Sully, is absolutely crucial for anybody sitting in the White House. And the tragedy is that it probably will be Trump who gets the praise for the current economic recovery, because guess what? In politics, you don't get a lot of credit for avoiding a disaster. You do get a lot more credit for actually unleashing growth. And what really strikes me, having spoken to people like Jeff Immelt of GE or David Coates from Honeywell or Ray Dalio in recent days, is that all of them are saying actually something has changed since November the 8th. Animal spirits are back. And it's really been the animal spirits, that sense of optimism, that willing to take risks and to invest and spend money, which has been missing for the last 8 years of Obama's presidency. And as I said before, in some ways, that is tragic.
So the short-term political legacy is unclear, and we will discover that over the next 4 years or so. But it seems that both of you are saying the long arc of history is solidly pro-Obama in the sense that he avoided a disaster that may go down in history as a footnote. But thank God it's a footnote, right, Kenneth?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Franklin Roosevelt, he's a hero. But if you look at the policies he did, he was flailing away. He did a lot of things that were counterproductive, but he's kind of got the job done. I think President Obama, at least on the economic side, will be viewed fully on par with Bill Clinton, Ronald Reagan, you know, his post-war presidents. I agree with Jillian about the business of jobs. But, you know, frankly, a lot of this is a bigger arc of history. It's a similar problem all across the world, just the way agricultural jobs of, you know, more than half of all American jobs at one time now, they're almost nothing. Just the way they faded, manufacturing jobs are going to fade. Even if we have manufacturing in the U.S., it's going to be more robots. There's this romanticism for that's the ideal American job. It's not going to be there. There's been a lot of transition. And that would have happened with or without the financial crisis, but the financial crisis made it a lot more painful.
But here's quite an important statistic. Ray Dalio from Bridgewater's calculated that if you look at how many years of relevant business experience you currently have in the top 8 members of Trump's team, it's 83. That is higher than any other administration for pretty much the last century. If you look at how many years of relevant business experience Obama's team had, it's 5. And that helps to explain exactly why, in a way, business did not respond with wild enthusiasm to Obama's policies because, for better or worse, they were not particularly pro-market, pro-business friendly.
I just want to push back on that a little bit. I mean, there are animal spirits, but I think a lot of it has to do with this feeling that there's going to be sweeping deregulation. And I'm a huge President Obama fan. I think he did a great job. I do think over the last couple years of his administration, he sort of let his aides run wild a bit with putting in regulations, which were well-intentioned, maybe a good idea in the long run, but rather dramatic. You know, a lot of these changes we needed, environmental regulation, you sweep them back in the short run, it's great for the economy. Of course it's good for animal spirits. We might not be able to breathe in 30 years, but, you know, in the short run, it's good. And I think a lot of the enthusiasm comes from this rollback of regulations, not just the business experience. And it's a very mixed blessing.
Kenneth Rogoff is a professor of economics at Harvard, former chief economist with the International Monetary Fund. Jillian Tett is U.S. managing editor of the Financial Times. Jillian, Kenneth, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It is a war of unparalleled brutality.
If you were to have asked the average American at the beginning of 1967 who was the enemy of the United States, the answer would have been Russia, certainly, and Red China. Of course, it was the height of the Cold War. The Vietnam War was then President Lyndon Johnson's most complex inheritance from the Kennedy years. It was part of the Cold War. But at first, Johnson fought it as a rescue mission for an Asian nation, South Vietnam, being absorbed by the communist threat to the North.
Simple farmers are the targets of assassination and kidnapping. Women and children are strangled in the night because their men are loyal to their government.
But 2 years into his short first term, President Lyndon Johnson, on the advice of his military advisors, escalated the war. In 1965, the War of the French Colonies, along with a tiny contingent of some U.S. covert military trainers, became a military conflict close to the scale of World War II, fighting the specter of global communism. At home, the narrative of the first televised war in America was the good guys shooting down the evil Reds.
These Marines on patrol made contact with the elusive enemy. But the VC, already aware he has little chance of winning a stand-up fight, is learning he is being engaged by a fighting force quite different from that he met and defeated a decade ago.
Any other messages were drowned out by the Johnson administration. Here's Defense Secretary Robert McNamara arguing Vietnam was a humanitarian war.
All Navy and Air Force pilots participating in these strikes were specially briefed by their commanding officers on the importance of avoiding civilian and build-up areas.
But the enemy was unmoved, a different enemy, North Vietnam. The country fought hard. From the capital city of Hanoi, there spewed out all kinds of anti-American propaganda.
Nothing is more confused than to be ordered into a war to die or to be maimed for life without the faintest idea of what's going on.
They lie to you, D.I. You know you cannot win this war. Your rich leaders grow richer while you're dying in the swamp, D.I.
And it was at this moment, 50 years ago, that Harrison Salisbury, a reporter for the New York Times known as a journalistic one-man band, risked his career and was granted access into evil North Vietnam. Salisbury became the first American to report from the forbidden anti-American city of Hanoi Hana, the city of the enemy, Hanoi. Salisbury would report the other side of the war, and his first article came out in the late edition of Christmas 1966, a Sunday. Contrary to the impression given by the United States communiques, on-the-spot inspection indicates that American bombing has been inflicting considerable civilian casualties in Hanoi and its environs for some time past. Lyndon Johnson and Robert McNamara's line since the start of the war was, yes, we're bombing North Vietnam, but only targets of, quote, concrete and steel, not human life. And on New Year's Eve, Johnson held a press conference at his ranch calling Vietnam the most careful, self-limited air war in history. Byline Harrison Salisbury, January 1, 1967. In the district as a whole, officials said there have been more than 150 attacks since 1965. The hospital has been dispersed into half a dozen thatched huts around the countryside. Authorities say it is too dangerous to occupy any substantial building. Most such buildings in the region, they say, have been hit by bombs. As the gap grew between what people read in the New York Times and what the government said, LBJ doubled down in his January 10th State of the Union.
Fear of external communist conquest in many Asian nations is already subsiding. And with this, the spirit of hope is rising.
Clearly, Harrison Salisbury, the reporter, was getting through, speaking truth to President Johnson. This recorded conversation between LBJ and Robert McNamara tells it all. It took place in late January of 67.
Now, what is the New York Times warning?
The Times internally is split on the Salisbury articles, and they have some impression that we have some photographs that would support Salisbury, and they're just bound determined to get those photographs out of us.
You tell them to go screw themselves, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah,
and just say, we don't think we owe the New York Times a god. Okay, we're not going to help you destroy this country knowingly.
Yeah, this is what I've done. And...
But some in America concluded that Salisbury was a turncoat to the communist side, having reported from Moscow for years. In reality, the American government knew that Salisbury was onto something. A secret CIA memo in December of 1966 found that over 75% of the casualties in the previous year were civilians. A month later, a CIA cable said that Salisbury's reporting was, quote, good, but that he hadn't described the full extent of the damage. Here's Salisbury in an interview in 1969.
Mr. Johnson's position became attenuated because, really, just to take the flank over the main observation that I reported from Vietnam, which was that we were hitting civilian objectives and killing civilians. But an irrational position was taken for propaganda purposes that we were bombing steel and concrete and so forth and so on. Well, this is fine up to a point, but once people see that this is not really so, you're really out on a limb and you just, somebody gives it a little shake and you fall down. There's just no place to go but down.
Meanwhile, J. William Fulbright, senator from Arkansas and longtime war opponent, began holding hearings on the war. And in his inability to get a straight answer from the Johnson administration, he said there was a, quote, credibility gap between what we know about the war and what the administration was saying. This credibility gap became the issue that candidates picked up on in the coming 1968 election. The incumbent president was suddenly vulnerable. Michigan Governor George Romney, 1967.
Well, I think I meant the same thing that some of you meant when you've written about the credibility gap and about manipulation of the news. And I wasn't talking about Russian-type brainwashing. I was talking about LBJ-type brainwashing.
Perhaps the place to start looking for a credibility gap is not in the offices of the government in Washington, but in the studios of the networks in New York.
That's Richard Nixon's running mate Spiro Agnew during the 68 campaign. Suddenly, the media was complicit in a failed effort to cover up an unraveling situation in Vietnam. The secret CIA reports would become the celebrated Pentagon Papers that confirmed Salisbury's reporting from Hanoi, commissioned by Defense Secretary McNamara in response to growing questions on the bombing efforts in North Vietnam. It was just 6 months after Salisbury's reporting in June of 1967. The untenability of the Vietnam War eventually drove Lyndon Johnson from running for a second full term.
I have heard all the years I've been a reporter that what a newspaper reader wants is the truth and nothing but the truth.
Harrison Salisbury speaking in 1988.
But it turns out that there are many, many truths. And the truth which is presented by that reporter in the New York Times or the Minneapolis Journal may not be the truth of the reader of that particular newspaper. If you don't believe that, try covering the man in the White House. And I don't care which man it is. My experience, peripheral, I will admit, have convinced me that there has never been anyone in the White House who liked a newspaper reporter.
And that is certainly the case today. As we all argue over whether the media created this president or is trying to undermine this new president, it's comforting to remember that the media's credibility and a president's credibility comes down to one reporter trying to get a story and that president deciding to disclose the truth or cover it up. Our thanks to the LBJ Presidential Library in Austin, Texas for some of the archival material in this piece and to independent producer Steve Atlas for bringing it to our attention. With PRI, Atlas is now at work on a radio documentary on LBJ and the Vietnam War. One of the United States' key allies in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, has its neighbor in a military stranglehold. The Saudi-led coalition fight against the Houthi rebels in Yemen that began in March of 2015 has killed more than 7,000 people. There are now more than 2 million children suffering from severe malnutrition. On top of that, increased blockades and airstrikes have made it tougher for humanitarian groups to supply the country with aid. Adam Barron is visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations and researcher at the Institute for Social Anthropology at the Austrian Academy of Sciences. He calls Yemen, chillingly, the other Syria.
I think there are a broad degree of similarities between Yemen and Syria. Although I would say when you look at the numbers, I think first off, the numbers in Yemen are far more severe. You have a situation where roughly 70% of the Yemeni population is in need of some sort of food aid. You have factors where the entire healthcare system has collapsed to an extent that you haven't really seen in Syria. For better or for worse, in Syria, you do have this sort of Assad rump state that remains somewhat resilient. In Yemen, the state has collapsed to a much larger degree. The key difference, though, is that while you've had a refugee crisis able to happen in Syria, the situation in Yemen is so bad that there a refugee crisis is not possible, in the sense that if you look at the geography for Syria, Syrians have a lot of places where they can flee. They can go to Jordan. They can go to Lebanon. They can go to Turkey. They can flee on the Mediterranean. And I think it's a testament to how severe the situation in Yemen is that we're talking about this in a positive sense, where for Yemenis, because you're hemmed in by Saudi Arabia and Oman, which have traditionally are very hard for Yemenis to get visas to, and on the other end, the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean, you're really looking at a situation where most Yemenis have nowhere to run.
Then why is it very public, the U.S.'s dispute with Russia and Iran over the humanitarian crisis in Syria and the extent to which those nations are enabling it, while none of the same criticism of the Saudis and no sense of alarm and emergency in Yemen?
Well, I think the key fact is you have a situation where the U.S. military is aiding sort of anti-Assad forces in Syria, whereas in Yemen, the U.S. is part and parcel of the Saudi-led coalition against the Houthis. So the U.S. is part of this conflict. The Saudis are flying, for the most part, American planes, dropping American bombs with American assistance. So I think this is something that's a bit inconvenient for the U.S. to admit. I think when you saw particularly Samantha Powers' comments about the humanitarian crisis in Syria criticizing the Russians, a lot of Yemenis looked at this and saw it as very hypocritical, in the sense that it's a sense that the world is really ignoring Yemen. Of course, this is something that nations that are sort of partially responsible for the crisis, for the humanitarian crisis in Syria have taken advantage of. Yemen has been reduced in a lot of cases to kind of a point of what you can refer to as whataboutery. That doesn't reduce the fact that Yemen is the Middle East's most significant and most severe humanitarian crisis. And this is not something that is liminal. This isn't something that's just going to go away when the conflict ends. This is something that will shape and affect Yemen, not just for years, but for generations to come.
That's what's so frustrating to me, though, Adam, because, I mean, you can make the case in places like Congo and Somalia that the Cold War and the U.S. involvement years and years and years ago might have led to a humanitarian situation there. But, oh, my gosh, it's just so out of our view right now. But this is actively abetted by the U.S. right now, this crisis. It just seems so at odds with what we've typically done, and it seems really at odds with what the Obama administration talks about. We're causing a famine, helping to cause a famine in Yemen.
I mean, the U.S. is not alone. These are all a number of factors that are causing this famine in Yemen. Yemen, of course, you know, was already on the verge of a humanitarian crisis a few years ago when I was traveling in the province of Hudaydah, which is now one of the provinces that's most affected by the famine in Yemen. You already had NGOs, humanitarian groups, warning of an impending catastrophe. Now you're seeing the war obviously set things over the edge. Of course, the Houthis and their allies are not blameless as well. They've been holding the city of Taiz under an effective siege for over a year now. So there's a lot of factors causing this humanitarian crisis. But what's more disturbing, I mean, then we can talk about U.S. complicity and the fact that the U.S. is involved in this. What's more disturbing to me personally is that it's not getting any attention at all. This is a war that's occurring, probably one of the most important and destabilizing conflicts in the entire region, if not the world. One of, if not the world's most significant humanitarian crises. And if you take 10 people off the streets in the United States, I would be surprised if one out of the 10 would even be aware that the U.S. is involved in a conflict in Yemen, or even that there's a war going on in the country.
What would change things?
I think there needs to be more pressure on all sides to end the conflict. That's really a key thing. In the interim of that, the key thing for me, in my opinion, is that you need to have increasing opening. Commercial trade needs to be going in and out of key Yemeni ports, both Hodeidah, which is currently under control of the Houthis and their allies, and Aden and Mukalla, which are under the control of the internationally recognized government. You need to have, I think, a greater acknowledgement to the fact that aid alone will not solve this. People often speak of humanitarian aid, and humanitarian aid is obviously very important. But when you have numbers of the severity that Yemen is seeing right now, when you have a situation where 70-80% of the population needs humanitarian aid, there's no way that need will be met. It's not going to happen. This is reflective of the larger collapse of Yemen's economy and trade networks that have been keeping this country, you know, the basic things that keep a country afloat, the basic things that allow that keep a country with food in its markets, with fuel to power cars, fuel to power tractor trailers, which are taking things from place to place. These entire things that we don't even think about have collapsed in Yemen. So really, in the absence of rebuilding this, which is something that can still be done, I think, within the conflict framework, it would just require some buy-in from a lot of key parties, which easier said than done, obviously. But in the absence of the rebuilding and the restructuring of these networks, we're going to see Yemen continue to deepen further into this really horrific crisis.
Adam Barron is a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations and a researcher at the Institute for Social Anthropology at the Austrian Academy of Sciences. He spoke to us from Beirut. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you so much.
Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. You can also check out the latest John Hockenberry blog post and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
He beats me. Straight up. Pay him.
I win! I'm a lawyer! That's my job! That's what I do!
I won. You lost. Get used to the idea, son.
Race? He's a race! I hope I win.
It's Friday, and it's time to talk about movies. So I'm going to talk with Raper Guzman about the Golden Globes instead. What?
Huh? Yes, indeed.
Jimmy Fallon will be running the show.
That's right. He'll be replacing Ricky Gervais.
Now, people think of Fallon as kind of the Leno, safety, fluffy, jokey guy, but he's immensely talented, Fallon is. I'm a big fan.
He's super funny. He's great. He's very charismatic. He's endearing, likable. I think Fallon's going to be the right choice for this show this year. I think Ricky Gervais, that sort of mean-spirited, envelope-pushing, I don't think that's going to work that well after the election season we just saw. I think people are a little sick of being insulted at this point. I think he could do very well.
He'll have some zingers, too, I have a feeling. The writers will get something in there.
Pretty soft zingers, don't you think?
Nerf
dart zingers.
I'll definitely watch the Nerf show, Golden Globes. All right, so you have some predictions here, and it's a chance to really look at some movies that were very, very, very good this year. And small movies, some of them, but still really good.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things we're going to see is Moonlight is probably going to win for Best Picture Drama. That's that movie about an African-American kid, gay, who's growing up in Miami.
Found him in a hole on 15. Yeah, that one. Some boys chased him in the cut. He's scared more than anything. He wouldn't tell me where he lived till this morning.
Well, thanks for seeing to him. He usually can take care of himself. Be good that way, but...
I think that's a great movie. I think it'd be very interesting to see a little art film like that, which has been a big critical hit, win at the Globes.
La La Land is also a big cult favorite and a great, great movie. Tell us about that. Remind us about that.
So that's the musical with Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling. Original musical, not based on any other play or pre-existing work. Wholly original. Huge critical hit. What's interesting, I think, this year for the Globes is usually we look at the Best Picture Drama category to predict the Oscar, which sometimes happens, sometimes doesn't. We never really look at the motion at the musical or comedy category to predict the Oscar, but I think it will in this case because I think La La Land is going to be the night's huge winner, and I think that will go on to win Best Picture at the Oscars.
Should we hear a little music with Emma Stone and Ryan Gosling?
Do it.
I got a call back.
What? Come on. For what?
For a TV show. The one that I was telling you about earlier.
The Dangerous Minds meets the OC?
Yeah.
Congratulations. That's
really
incredible.
Exciting. I feel like I said negative stuff about it before.
What?
It's like Rebel Without a Cause, sort of.
I got the bullets.
Yes.
You've never seen it.
I've never seen it.
That's great.
I hope I get it. I hope I get it.
Exactly. Exactly right. Okay, from musicals about L.A. to astronauts.
I will have you know, I was the first Negro female student at West Virginia University Graduate School. On any given day, I analyze the manometer levels for air displacement, friction, and velocity, and compute over 10,000 calculations by hand. So yes, they let women do some things at NASA, Mr. Johnson. And it's not because we wear skirts. It's because we wear glasses.
Taraji Henson there with Mahershala Ali, women working for NASA. This is a very typical Hollywood African-American empowerment movie, but there's a lot more going on as far as diversity is concerned at this year's Golden Globes.
Yeah. Now, you know, as we all remember, the Oscars took a lot of heat for this couple of years running for the all-white acting categories. The Globes didn't get so much flack for that, but I do think you see a tremendous amount, at least relatively speaking, a tremendous amount of diversity this year. You've got seven non-white actors being nominated. Taraji Henson is not one, but Mahershala Ali from Hidden Figures and also for Moonlight, which is what he's nominated for. He's nominated. I think he'll win for Best Supporting Actor. I think Viola Davis will win Best Supporting Actress for Fences. Could go to Michelle Williams, your favorite, John, but I think it's going to be Viola.
Casey Affleck?
I think he will win for Best Actor for Manchester by the Sea for sure. But again, I'm telling you, La La Land, I think it's going to win six out of seven nominations. I think it's going to be the night's huge winner.
And there's all the TV stuff that we didn't even get to.
That's right. Not my
Golden
field.
Golden Globes. Something for everyone. But sticking to his field, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckabee. I can tell we are in the golden age of television because all the new shows that I assumed would just get canceled are coming back. I mean, these days, even if a big network drops a show, some other network will bring it back, new and improved. And part of this is just an increase in quality and daring across all the networks, but part of it is because the streamers in the world, the Amazons of the world, are increasing while the broadcast platforms are shrinking. It's all just more nirvana for Melissa Locker on her couch. She's culture reporter for Time, The Guardian, and The Takeaway. And she reports on the new television season. Coming back is the NBC drama This Is Us.
So this is the show's brand new first season. And I think this has been one of the breakout hits. It's very kind of family friendly. They tackle topics about, you know, weight and race and things that don't really get tackled in most TV shows.
I had this whole dream life that I envisioned for myself, a real career. And I would marry a man like Dad. I would be a mom like Mom. But look at me, Kev. Like, I ate my dream life away.
It seems a little sentimental, kind of like a cross between Crash and The Big Chill.
I can see why you think that, but honestly, I was so skeptical about this show. I didn't watch it until it was on Hulu one day, and I was like, okay, fine, I'm just going to watch it. And you watch the first episode, and I was totally hooked.
Wow.
And it ended on a serious cliffhanger, and it's coming back on January 10th, and I cannot wait, personally.
Series of unfortunate events?
So this was a series of books written by Lemony Snicket.
Right, I remember.
And it was made into a not very good movie starring Jim Carrey. And luckily, we live in a time where Netflix can take this kind of not very good movie, kind of ignore it, and redo the whole series and do it right. This one stars Neil Patrick Harris. I've only seen, like, segments of it, but it's so much better than the movie.
Homeland comes back for season six. They're jumping the shark. This can't possibly work.
I was very skeptical when I heard that they were coming back for a new season. I didn't know how long Claire Danes could kind of milk this, but it sounds like they've come up with sort of an interesting angle. So this time, Carrie Matheson, CIA agent extraordinaire, is not overseas, but she's actually in Brooklyn. And she is still trying to figure out what's going on. I've heard some rumors about this show, which could make it completely bananas, but I'm very optimistic for now.
Beaches?
Beaches. Come on. Do you want me to sing? Because I will sing.
I know you will. Well, this has got some voices in it.
Yeah, so it's a TV remake, recast with Idina Menzel, who, you know, is one of the greatest voices of the time. Did you ever know that you're my hero? Everything I wished I could be. No one's going to take the place of Bette Midler, but Idina Menzel comes close.
Yeah, oh, that's great. That's worth watching.
You're going to watch it, and you're going to cry your eyes out, and you're going to be super embarrassed, and all your kids are going to laugh at you.
Jane the Virgin, she can't still be a virgin.
She's no longer a virgin, but they're not going to change the name. She's happily married. She still is the mother of a young child. She still has some questions about everything in her life.
I'm sorry. I'm just terrified. Matteo was kidnapped. You were shot, and the woman who did it is still out there.
Exactly, and I want to put her behind bars.
But why you? Can't it be anybody else?
No one knows the case better than me.
Your own partner shot you!
It's this incredible telenovela. It's so funny and kind of heartwarming, and they don't take themselves very seriously. And if you don't watch the show for anything else, watch it for Rogelio, who is the telenovela star who came out to be and is Jane's father. And he's hilarious, and you don't really see characters like him on American television very often. The final season of Girls is about to start, and we don't know what's going to happen to these young women who are slowly maturing into fine, upstanding adults. And they are all millionaires.
Exactly. They also got to deal with Adam Driver, who's now, you know, part of Star Wars.
I know. I wonder if they can fit his ego on set. Ooh, probably. But the show is, you know, love it or hate it. I still don't quite understand why it's been classified as a comedy. But I do think that, you know, it's educational. If you want to see what kids are up to these days, this could give you some sort of insight.
Or just send you running for the hills. Melissa Locker, culture reporter for Time, The Guardian, and The Takeaway, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling, I'm happy again.
Everyone experienced in some way the loss of Carrie Fisher and her mother, Debbie Reynolds, last month within hours of each other. Whether you were coming out of Star Wars Rogue One, where Fisher had a cameo and discovered what happened, whether you were listening to Singin' in the Rain over the holidays, whether you followed it on the news, the collapse of Carrie Fisher on the plane, the coma, and then death, followed by her mother's quiet end with a fatal stroke. The lives of these two women were remarkable, Hollywood legends both in different ways and different generations, bound together as loving mother and daughter. And all this comes through in a film like no other. It's a documentary that's intimate, universal, and because Carrie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds are part of us, this film is also a part of our memories. Bright Lights, premiering on HBO tomorrow night, was rushed to the screen because of the tragedy that happened over Christmas. But that tragedy can't overwhelm the joy and wonder of this portrait of a daughter and her mom. Fisher Stevens is the director of Bright Lights, starring Carrie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds. He calls it a Hollywood love story, not least because it was a collaboration with his girlfriend, Alexis Bloom.
We didn't want to make a biopic, for sure, because right. There's so many bio things sure. about Carrie and Debbie.
Celebrity stuff.
No.
Just didn't interest you.
No. But what did interest us was the personalities and the clear love but strange relationship. So we wanted to explore the relationship.
The mother-daughter thing.
I'm going to go help my mother pack. My mother is performing a show in Connecticut. I tried to stop her. But that is like throwing yourself in front of what are those called? Not tiramisus. Tsunami. See, she's Tsumami. And I threw myself in front of Tsumami, and it didn't work. She loves doing it when she's doing it, but afterwards, she was laying on the floor. So, but in a good, dignified movie star way.
What evidence did you see of the possible frustration between these two, mother-daughter? Carrie is a, you know, formidable character, and yeah. a rebellious teen just begins to describe her.
Yeah, well, that was part of our intrigue, was that these two women had such big personalities and are so strong-willed. I mean, Debbie is no, you know, pushover by any means. The other thing was, I think that they were at a very good point in their relationship, and they'd been up through their ups and downs. And Carrie wanted to make this film because she was so enamored with her mother, obviously, and wanted the world to understand the greatness of Debbie. And Debbie didn't want us following her with a camera at all, but she was doing it because her daughter asked her to do it.
Everything in me demands that my mother be as she always was, even if that way is irritating. She just can't change. That's the rule.
When I and Lexi and I filmed her, Debbie performing and watching her struggling to get her toes in her stockings and having her assistant bend down on his knees and straightening her toes to fit in these high heels that she had to get on stage with. And then as soon as she got on the stage, she changed her personality completely and became, "Hello, everybody." And the audience applauded and she just lit up and immediately was just like this different, this performer.
Here we go. I hear the cut. Start over again. Maybe something will come out. I hear the cottonwoods whispering above.
What we didn't expect was that Debbie's health took a quite a sharp turn for the worse while we were filming.
She was the fragile one in all of this.
All of it. And the movie started to become about Carrie worrying about her mother.
Well, I worry what the show costs you. That's all. I know you like to do it.
I have caught up with a few people in age. Whoa.
But they're in bed and you're doing a show.
Like George Burns says, I'm going to stay on stage until I drop dead, and then I'm going to have myself stuffed like Trigger, and then I'll put me in a museum.
That's nice.
And there's a, you know, obviously there's a section in the film where it becomes about, like, is my mom going to be okay? And of course, because Debbie Reynolds is unsinkable, she comes back and does another nightclub act, even after she basically had a little stroke.
For two generations, these faces are imprinted on our entertainment history, all of our memories. I mean, particularly with the Star Wars memories. I mean, Carrie Fisher is alive today, regardless of what happened. Debbie Reynolds, for a generation, is also no different. What is that like?
Well, I think that's also informed their personalities, obviously, so to speak, because Debbie was 19 when she did Singing in the Rain and became a movie star, and she started to cultivate this personality. And then Carrie trying to define who Carrie was, because she needed the attention of her mother, because her mother, she felt she shared with everybody when she was little, because there were so many fans always around, and her father having left the family and abandoned her. So she cultivated this personality, and was always brilliant. I mean, there's a clip in the film where she's 15 years old and she gets on stage and sings Bridge Over Troubled Waters in her mother's nightclub act and just blows people's minds.
Come on, sing it for your old mother.
When you're weary, feeling small.
She had this incredible singing voice, which she decided not to do really anything with professionally.
Your eyes, I will dry them.
So she really took this she made this choice. I'm going to be funny. I'm going to be witty because I have it. And that's what's going to get me through. And then got this movie at 19, which she thought was going to be kind of maybe a, you know, interesting kind of B
5 minutes
movie. Yeah. And it just, like, it's so bizarre, that element that they were both 19 and they both hit this huge stardom, and they're a force. They're these two incredible individuals, but you put them together and it's just like explosive.
What's a mother and daughter to take from this film? You know, I mean, we're not celebrities, but there's such a power here.
It's a love story about a mother and a daughter. Any mother and daughter can relate to it, and son, because Todd Fisher plays a big role in the film.
Sure.
And it's a story that we can all relate to because, you know, our mothers get old, our daughters have issues with whatever. And the beauty of Carrie and Debbie was that they really did work out their stuff.
How did you hear about Carrie Fisher's decline?
Well, Lexi and I were in South Africa on vacation, and so it's quite a time difference from Los Angeles. I happened to be up. It was like 1 a.m. It was just like so shocking. And at one point it seemed like, okay, well, maybe she's Carrie. She's going to come back. And, you know, she was in a coma for a while, and then she couldn't hold on. And then we went to sleep, and then woke up the next morning, and Debbie, it was just weird. It still feels very weird, and like you're going to get on the phone or see Carrie, and, you know, I can't watch the film, you know, but
as sad as it is, there's an element of Hollywood in this.
I know, it's really...
Isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
What is that all about?
I don't know. And, you know, there's a big theme in our film is Christmas, because Carrie and Debbie have Christmas trees in their house all year round, both of them. And Carrie says in the movie, you know, I love Christmas, you know, and we cut to the tree and I don't know. And the whole thing happened, you know, over the Christmas break. And I don't, it's just the whole thing is surreal, surreal. But
they wrote their ending.
They sort of did.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. And they will live on.
Fisher Stevens is director of Bright Lights, starring Carrie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds, premiering tomorrow night on HBO. Do you have a special family relationship? I did with my mother when she died. I didn't care if I lived or died. The only thing that kept me going was my newborn son, Eli, says Petoskey, Michigan. Tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.